This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's Sports Stories with Heart, a program by, for, and about human interest stories in sports that touches the heart. These stories include local high schools and colleges of Worcester County, Massachusetts, as well as national and international athletic people and events. This program is brought to you by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. My name is Mr. Ron, and today I have the extreme pleasure of again having as a guest Vin Femia, the author who previously produced books about the Boston Red Sox and the New England Patriots, and now is about to have produced his new book, Glory Days, about the Boston Celtics. Vin, hello. Glad to have you aboard.
Thank you, Mr. Ron. I'm glad to be here.
Could you tell us something about your new book?
Yep. It's about the championship history of the Celtics. And they've had 18 championships in the years that they've been in existence, which began in 1946. So I cover each one of those championship years. And one year there was an almost championship that probably should have been, which was 1973. Maybe we'll get into that later on in the discussion here.
Was that when Bill Russell was hurt?
No. Bill Russell was hurt in 1958, and they lost to the Hawks. But that's a year that they had the best year in the franchise history, 68 wins, with Dave Cowens and John Havlicek and JoJo White. But they lost to the Knicks in the Eastern Finals in a game seven, but game four was one that was very controversial. And again, we can talk about that later if you would like.
Sure. And you come out in this book with the indication that the Celtics have had more to overcome to have this record than other teams that have great records.
Yes. In fact, as you know, because you've read this, I consider the Celtics to be the greatest team in the history of professional sports in North America, in part because of what they had to overcome, and in part in comparison to other teams. For example, that may be a controversial statement, because people may say, no, the Yankees are the most successful team in professional sports, or Canadians in hockey. But one big element for the Yankees is that they always had the money to spend, and they did spend, in order to build their teams, primarily because broadcast rights in New York were just so much higher than places like Kansas City or Milwaukee or other places. So the Yankees had money to spend, and they did spend money. The Canadians were one of two professional hockey teams in Canada early on, along with the Toronto Maple Leafs, so they had their pick of the Canadian talent. Meanwhile, the Celtics were operating on a shoestring because their owner did not have the money to compete with some of the other teams in both his sport and the other sports. So they had to get by on intelligence and guile and clever drafting and trades. For example, one of the keys to the franchise was Bill Russell, of course, who led them to 11 championships in 13 years. And they got him because of clever dealings by Walter Brown the year that Bill Russell was coming out in the draft, which was 1956. The Celtics had the number three pick in the draft, and they wanted Russell. Red Auerbach, who was their newish coach, wanted somebody who could rebound, play defense, and get the ball out to Bob Cousy to start the Celtics' fast break. So ahead of him in the draft were the Rochester Royals and the St. Louis Hawks. So the reason they got the Royals to agree not to draft Bill Russell is that they offered the owner of the Rochester Royals the Ice Capades. And they said they'd bring the Ice Capades to Rochester if they would just not draft Bill Russell. So Rochester agreed to that. Then the Celtics drafted a couple of their players, Ed McCauley, who was an all-star, and Cliff Hagan, for the rights to the second pick, which they used to pick Bill Russell. And then Russell and Cousy teamed up for multiple championships. I'm dragging out a little bit here, but if you want to... Okay. But another team that sometimes you could say, well, they're the greatest team, is the Lakers in the Celtics' own league, in the NBA. But the Lakers, like the Knicks, I mean, like the Yankees and like the Knicks in basketball, always had money, and they could spend it on players, and they could attract them to the warmth and sun in Los Angeles as opposed to the cold in Boston or Milwaukee or other places. And they've also, I'm going to say, hoodwinked some other teams in deals to get some of the greatest players in the history of the game. They got Wilt Chamberlain from the Philadelphia 76ers for three people who I bet nobody who's listening, unless you're a real big basketball fan, would remember. It's Daryl Imhoff, Archie Clark, and Jerry Chambers. They got Kareem Abdul-Jabbar for, again, four people who people in general would not remember. Junior Bridgman, David Myers, Elmore Smith, and Brian Winters. They got Magic Johnson by trading with the Utah Jazz of an aged Gail Goodrich for the number one pick in the draft. They got Kobe Bryant because he didn't want to play for the Charlotte Hornets who drafted him. So that they arranged a trade for that. And even just recently, last year, I remember waking up one morning and my wife telling me, "Did you hear about the Lakers Mavericks trade?" And I jokingly said, "Oh, did the Lakers get Luka Doncic?" And she said, "Yes." And I just was, you know, just shocked. It's like the Mavericks traded a 25-year-old superstar who had led them to the finals to a team that always beat them in the playoffs, the Lakers, for a center, Anthony Davis, who was always hurt and, in fact, had been on the Lakers because he quit on his own team, New Orleans, and got himself traded to the Lakers. So my claim is that the Celtics are the greatest team of all time. And I even have the numbers to back it up, if you'll let me do that.
Absolutely.
So as of the time that I wrote the book in 2024, after the championship, the Celtics had won 18 titles in 77 years for 23.8% wins. The Lakers had 17 titles, 22%. The Yankees had 21% of their league's titles, with 27 titles in 124 years. And the Canadiens had also 21.5% for 23 titles in the NHL's 107 years. And the last thing I'll say, and then we can move on, is since 1946, when the NBA was created, the title count of all those teams, the Celtics have 18, the Canadiens have 18, the Lakers and Yankees have 17. So just some facts and some statistics to back up my claim that the Celtics are the greatest team in the history of professional sports in North America.
Well, I know that they give us a great game almost every night.
Yes.
And even the current team, which was downplayed by most people early in the season, has come through to the point where they are interesting and they're extremely competitive. And I think that the present coach has finally shown that he is a good coach, and it's not one of those situations just that he was blessed with the team that he got.
Well, everybody thought this would be an interesting year without Jason Tatum and having them have to give up because of the salary cap considerations. Al Horford and Kristaps Porzingis and Jrue Holiday. But I always liked Jaylen Brown, too, and he's really showing what kind of player he can be with his play, not only his scoring but his passing and leadership. So this will be a very interesting team to watch. How far will they go? Who knows? But as you said, and I absolutely agree, they're a very entertaining team to watch.
Well, they're playing nine players at the present time. They're not keeping everybody on the bench as they have in the past. And when you talk about Jaylen Brown, I think he is a terrific player, but he has the problem of trying to dribble through everybody in the keyhole, and that has been his downfall.
I agree. And he's gotten better of not doing that. But for the last few years, remember the year that they were in the finals against the Golden State Warriors?
Yes.
The Warriors would just clog the middle of the lane and steal the ball from Jaylen Brown. But he's worked on his game. And that's another thing that I like about him and other players in Celtics history, is they don't just rest during the offseason. They work on their games to try to improve. And he did that. One story about Jaylen Brown, by the way. We were Celtics season ticket holders for years, and we get invited to things like their draft night extravaganza, where they just come and they feed you some food and so on, and then you can hear what their draft picks are before they're announced on TV. And when the Celtics, who had the number three pick that year, drafted Jaylen Brown, people in the crowd booed. And they booed because they wanted another player. I think Chris Humphreys was a player that the most of the fans wanted. And I'm thinking, let's at least give this kid a chance. You know, he hasn't played a minute of NBA basketball. The Celtics thought highly enough of him to draft him. Let's give him a chance instead of booing the Celtics for drafting him. And I think the Celtics have been very happy over the years that they wound up with that draft pick of Jaylen Brown.
And I think the Celtics and Boston and the entire area should be very happy with Stevens as the president and the brains behind putting the club together.
Absolutely. I think he's done a great job. I thought he was an excellent coach when he was the coach of the Celtics. And now he's been an excellent general manager as well, just doing the things that he did to get the Celtics under the salary cap. And think of the players that he's brought in and drafted. He drafted Jordan Walsh, who's now a starter on the team and really has improved his game. He traded for Josh, I think, I forget whether a trade or a free agent signing, Josh Minot, who is a great player off the bench. And, you know, he's made the right moves. I know I've talked to Bob Ryan, who's a sports writer for the Boston Globe, and his theory about the Celtics is, in Brad we trust, because of Stevens' acumen at being able to see basketball talent and help develop basketball talent. One other story that I'll tell you is, at one point, I think when the NCAA championship game, it was Butler, which was coached by Brad Stevens, and Duke, which was coached by legendary Mike Krzyzewski. And Danny Ainge was sitting in the crowd. I forget who he was sitting with, but he said to somebody, I think that's the best coach in America. And whoever he was with said, yeah, sure, everybody thinks that about Mike Krzyzewski. And Danny Ainge said, no, Brad Stevens, I think, is the best coach in America. And he signed him as the Celtic coach, and I think Stevens had an excellent career as coach. I was surprised when he took over as the general manager, but I think he's been, as you said, very good in that job, and he's helped to build this team.
And Danny Ainge had a great experience putting the team together that won the championship. And he came here originally as a terrific player.
Yep.
He made his real fame in a game down in Providence in the national basketball tournament when he took the ball, went the length of the court, and beat Notre Dame.
That's right.
At the buzzer.
Yeah, and went past all five Notre Dame players to lay it in and win the game for Brigham Young. That's right.
And I was fortunate enough to be at that game.
That's pretty good. You're a lucky man to see games like this. And Ainge, you may remember, was also a baseball player. He was with the Toronto Blue Jays.
But he couldn't hit.
He couldn't hit. That's right.
Yeah, he ended up with a 222 average
something like that,
and decided to stay in pro basketball.
Yeah, and the Celtics had to deal with Toronto to try to get him out of the Toronto contract and be able to sign him. And eventually they convinced him, I think because of what you just said, I think Toronto saw that Danny Ainge's future was not in baseball.
Right. And he was a very, very personable individual.
Mm-hmm. And he built the championship team that won with Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and Ray Allen with really good moves when the Celtics were, you know, unlucky enough not to get the number one pick in the draft the year that Tim Duncan came out and the year that somebody like Kevin Durant came out and the Celtics were interested in drafting. But he built the team despite the disappointments of losing those draft lotteries.
Well, in my spare time, whenever that is, I have sat around on occasion and tried to decide what was the great Celtic Five. What you could put together as the five best players. I came up with Bill Russell, Bob Cousy, then...
You were talking about Havlicek, I think.
I had Havlicek and...
Tatum.
Tatum.
Oh, Bird. You forgot Bird.
And Larry Bird. But I wasn't sure on Havlicek as one of the greatest five. And I'd love your opinion as to who would fill that bill.
Well, that's a good question. Like, John Havlicek is my all-time favorite athlete in all of sports. I think he was a class player on the field, on the court, rather. He was a class player off the class person off the court. So my five would be similar to yours. Bill Russell, obviously. Larry Bird, obviously. Bob Cousy, the Houdini of the hardwood. Mm-hmm. Mr. Basketball when he was playing. John Havlicek would be my fourth. And if I could put Dave Cowens at forward, I might put Dave Cowens at forward on that team. If not, maybe Kevin McHale would be another good choice. But the Celtics have had a lot of good players, as you know.
They sure have.
You could also make a case for Paul Pierce, for example, who was
absolutely
a great player there. And Tommy Heinsohn, who was so underrated in his career. You know, Heinsohn played with Cousy, played with Russell. And so maybe he didn't get the headlines that other players would have or that he could have if he was somewhere else.
And then he ended up as their announcer.
And the coach before that.
And the coach. He had a great career there. And at the same time, he was busy selling insurance.
That's right.
In Boston.
And painting. He was also an accomplished painter, an artist.
That I was not aware of.
Yep. But yes, he was selling insurance. And then Fred Auerbach brought him in to announce some of the games with him at one point. And that just kicked off Tommy's announcing career.
And when we talk about the Celtics and the history of the Celtics, one name we cannot forget is Johnny Most.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm not going to try to do a Johnny Most impression, but people love him, and there used to be contests for trying to speak like Johnny Most or announcing like Johnny Most. And you know, and I bet a lot of our listeners know, that one of the greatest clips in any sports history is the clip of Johnny Most doing Havlicek stole the ball in the 1965 playoffs against Wilt Chamberlain and the Philadelphia 76ers.
Absolutely. Getting back to Johnny Most, I think that people from our generation, earlier than this generation, believed in him and knew that he was the biggest homer had ever seen.
That's for sure. You know, I remember Johnny calling Bill Laimbeer and Rick Mahorn of Detroit McFilthy and McNasty because of their play. And I think he imparted some of that to Tommy Heinsohn, because Tommy Heinsohn also became a homer during his announcing days. And he hated the referees. Tommy Heinsohn was not a big fan of NBA refereeing. Neither am I, by the way.
Well, today's team for the Celtics is totally different than the type of team we've seen over the last generation.
Mm-hmm.
They've all of a sudden seemingly have developed some great players out of kids who came out of college
mm-hmm.
without the refinement. Would you talk about that?
Yep. There are a couple that really come to mind, and I'm sure we agree on these. We've talked about this. Peyton Pritchard is one who came out of Oregon as a small guard. In fact, I think he won the Bob Cousy Award as the best small basketball player in college basketball. But for a couple of years, he did not get much playing time with the Celtics. But if you watch the games closely, you saw that whenever he came in, he handled the ball very well, hardly ever turned it over. And I kept thinking he should get more playing time. then a couple of years ago, he started getting more playing time, and we saw what he did. He was one of the stars of the championship team of 2024. I'm sure you listeners will remember all of those long shots that he was taking at the end of quarters and making them, including a big one in the game that won the championship for them that year. But he on the court handles the ball better than some large 90% of the players in the league. Another one is Keita, who is, I think, Nemus Keita. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his first name correctly because I've heard it pronounced multiple ways. But he's a strong rebounding center and good defensive center. And he also is pretty good at setting picks for the team and then rolling to the basket for good high lob passes for alley-oop plays to score. And you mentioned another one when we were talking before the radio broadcast.
Walsh seems to have come out of nowhere all of a sudden in the middle of this season.
Yeah, you know, this is a guy who's really developed his game. He was drafted a couple of years ago, got spotty playing time, and
Went to Maine,
spent a lot of time going back and forth between Maine and Boston, not getting a lot of time in Boston. But he's, like many Celtics over the years, he's worked on his game. He worked on his game during the offseason. He's now a very strong defensive player, and they often put him on the best scorer of the other team that they're playing, and he does a very good job with them. He's also developed a three-point shot, which makes him not a liability on the offensive end. So, you know, those three. And I'll add another one, Hugo Gonzalez, who they drafted this year, who, you know, came out of Madrid in the European League. Looks like a guy who's a very good hustler, very good basketball skills and abilities, another guy who defends well. And I think he'll be a good addition to the team as they go forward as well. So they're building a strong nucleus of young players, which I think is the point you were making, with people like, you know, Walsh and Keita and Pritchard and Gonzalez and others.
And I think, in truth, the team, as it's now compiled, is more interesting to watch than the team that we had for the last couple of years, which did nothing but shoot threes.
Oh, that used to drive me crazy. It's like, especially, there was one playoff game last year against the Knicks where they missed 45 three-point shots, and they only made 15. So they missed 45 out of 60 free throws. And it's like, this is where I drive my wife crazy, because I'll rant and rave about stop shooting the three-pointers. You know, you can score just as easily from inside as you can from outside. But that still is my one criticism of Joe Mazzulla, is that he still is in favor of that three-point shot. I mentioned Bob Bryan earlier. Bob Bryan is a noted sportscaster for the Boston Globe. Is also one who hates the three-point shot, and he thinks it's really taken things away from the game of basketball the way it should be played, and I agree.
Well, there's actually been some talk recently based on Pritchard's affinity for taking the long shot at the end of a period, taking a shot from almost mid-court or,
yep, or
beyond, where they have been talking, and some people have even been suggesting that they have a four-point shot.
Yeah, I know, and who knows? They may do that, too. You know, the leagues and the TV people love to see scoring. They love to see offense. We see that in pro football. We see that in pro basketball. I'm reminded of when they were introducing the three-point shot in the NBA, which was the 1979-1980 season. And Dave Cowens, who was a very rugged inside player, great rebounder, great defensive player, said, if you get 3 points for just shooting from the outside, how many should I get for really working for an offensive rebound and putting the ball back in, which is a lot more effort than shooting the three-pointer? So
that was an interesting thought.
Yep.
But he never got any place with it.
No, and he never would, because, you know, people love to see the three-pointers, and they love to see dunks, because those are the things that get the highlights on ESPN.
And when Cowens was in Boston at the time of the strike and the difficulty, he kept in touch with the fans and kept in the news by driving a taxi cab.
Dave Cowens was one of the most interesting individuals that the Celtics ever had. Yes, he drove a taxi cab. I'm sure you remember that he took a sabbatical one year because he felt his game wasn't the way that it should be. And I think he was also upset because one of the things the Celtics did the year before was get rid of Paul Silas, who was a good rebounding forward who worked very well with Cowens. So he had it built into his contract that he could take time off, and he did. It was the 1976-77 season, and he took time off and went back to his home in Kentucky and sold Christmas trees. And I think the night that they won the 1974 championship, Dave Cowens spent the night sleeping on a park bench in the Boston Common because he just had been celebrating and he didn't want the good feeling to go away. So, you know, when he was tired, he just decided, I'm going to just go sleep on that park bench, and he spent the night there.
Imagine that.
I'll tell you another thing that you couldn't imagine. We lived in Connecticut at the time, and we came up for some games, and I was looking through the phone book, and there in the phone book is Dave Cowens at his home in Weston, Massachusetts. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's what you do. I think he was a rookie or a second-year player. You get a job, you move into a new city, and you put your name in the phone book. And he may be the only sports star that I could think of who would think, well, I'll just put my name in the phone book just like anybody else would. But that's the way that he was.
Fascinating. Amazing how they have careers beyond the sport at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, and I'll get back to your new book, Glory Days. What other parts of the book do you think that the fans are going to find interesting? And do you have one little portion you'd like to read?
That's a good question. Let me just pick up on a couple of the highlights. The moves that they made, getting Bob Cousy because they pulled his name out of a hat. When one of the cities in the league folded, actually was Tri-Cities, and Bob Cousy and Max Aslofsky and Andy Phillip were available, and the league decided that there were three teams who were interested in the players. They'll put the names in the hat and pick them out. And actually, Walter Brown, the Celtic owner, who was a beloved owner of the Celtics, let the other teams go first, the Philadelphia Warriors, who are now in Golden State, and the Knicks. And so they picked their players, and they were Max Aslofsky and Andy Phillip. So the Celtics wound up with Bob Cousy. And what an odd way to get one of the best players in the history of the game, and as I said before, Mr. Basketball. Well, I want to pick up on one year that really is a key, 1969, the 68-69 season. The Lakers, who had been the Celtics' prime rivals over the years with Jerry West and Elgin Baylor, but they never had a center to match up with Bill Russell. Well, they got one. They got a guy by the name of Wilt Chamberlain, who was arguably one of the greatest players in sports history of all sports, and certainly one of the all-time greats in basketball. So now they had the big three with three of the all-time greats, Chamberlain, West, and Baylor. And everybody thought that the Celtics would win the championship. But what they forgot about was Celtic pride. And the Celtics wound up playing, the Celtics finished fourth in the East at that time, got into the finals against the Lakers, but the Lakers had home court advantage for the first time against the Celtics. But the Celtics took them to Game 7, and when Game 7 was about to start, Bill Russell, who was the player coach of the team at the time, came in and said, well, they've got a bunch of balloons ready to just drop when the Lakers win the championship. They've got this handwritten sheet of who's going to speak when and when the USC marching band is going to come out and celebrate, but we're going to win this game. And they went out and won that game. But if there's one area that I think would be of interest is when the Celtics lost for the first time in years in 1968. They had won 8 championships in a row. They had won 9 championships in 10 years. But that there was a great Philadelphia 76ers team with Wilt Chamberlain. And I'm looking for that area here. Oh, here it is. Okay. And the 76ers beat them in the Eastern Finals. And a couple of things that happened after that game. Wayne Embry, who had joined the team a couple of years, the year before, was saying, this team hasn't lost in a long time. What are they going to do now that they've lost? And what he was surprised at was when they came into the locker room, Bill Russell said, okay, guys, let's go congratulate the winners. So no complaining, no arguing. They lost to a team that was better than them that year, and they went to congratulate them. And then two quotes from John Havlicek. One, somebody came up to Havlicek after the Celtics were eliminated and said, well, how's it feel to be a loser? And Havlicek said something like, I've had too many good days to hang my head now. And then the other quote is at the team's breakup dinner that year, when here it is. John spoke for a few minutes and then smiled and ended his remarks with a very pointed and challenging comment to his teammates. We're only dead until October. So that was the 1967 season. Then the Celtics went on and won the championship in 1968, won the championship that I mentioned a minute ago in 1969. So, you know, they came through and, again, clasped by John Havlicek. And one other quote. After that 1968 series, when the Celtics had come back and won, there's a quote from Jerry West about Bill Russell. And they say, and he says, they can talk about individuals in any sport, but I tell you what, when it comes to winning, there is no one like him. I play this game and I know. Is there any greater tribute in sport than the simple one of being a winner? Is there? This guy here is the greatest of them all. And that he's speaking about Bill Russell. Again, Russell won 11 championships in 13 years after winning two NCAA titles with the University of San Francisco and after winning a gold medal with the United States Olympic team. In fact, Bill Russell has more championship rings in the NBA than he has fingers to put them on. 11 championships for 10 fingers.
Absolutely amazing. And the Celtics have had other players who have played two sports.
That's right.
They had Gene Conley.
Mm-hmm. Conley played for the Red Sox, pitched for the Red Sox, and was a backup center and forward for the Celtics, backing up Bill Russell.
Danny Ainge.
Oh, baseball and basketball again. Yep. I can't think of any others right off the top of my head.
No, it's a rarity.
Well, I think Bill Russell did track in college as well.
But, he did.
But you're talking about people who played professional sports.
Right. It's actually a rarity, but there are a few along the way, and the Celtics had a couple.
That's right.
We've seen football players. We've seen basketball players. We've seen baseball players. There's always in every generation somebody who doubles up.
Yep. Well, Bo Jackson, for example, who played football with the Raiders and baseball with the Kansas City Royals.
And then you have somebody like Babe Ruth, who played the outfield and pitched.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have
Shohei
Ohtani, who won the MVP in the National League again.
Yep, and is a very good pitcher and hitter. And now, of course, he's got back-to-back championships with the Dodgers, too.
Some of these people are absolutely amazing, and we look up to them, but you cannot imagine how great they are.
I'll name another one, Wilt Chamberlain, who I mentioned before.
Right.
Was a great basketball player, was a championship volleyball player, ran track in college, and I think there was talk back in the 1960s and 1970s about him taking up a boxing career and that boxing for the heavyweight championship against Muhammad Ali. And if anybody could do it, it was Wilt.
Yeah, he was a handful, but Bill Russell got the better of him year after year when he was at Philadelphia.
And one of the stories that I really like is, I forget what year it was. It might have been 1965 or something like that. The Philadelphia 76ers gave Wilt Chamberlain a contract for 1 year for $100,000, which was a big deal at the time, a $100,000 player. So Bill Russell went to Red Auerbach, and they agreed that they would pay Bill Russell $100,001. Now, that $1 didn't make a big difference in terms of the bank account, but it made a whole lot of difference to Bill Russell and the amount of pride that he felt in himself and how much the Celtics valued him. You know, he was just a little bit better than Wilt Chamberlain. And it kind of was amazing that Russell dominated him as much as he did, as you were saying, because Chamberlain was just such a physical marvel. But Russell played a team game. And, you know, the Celtics would pass and play defense, and they would play a five-man game a lot better than Wilt and whatever four men were on the court with him.
And isn't it amazing, after all these years, the Celtics are still a tenant of the ownership of the Boston, what we call the Boston Garden,
yeah,
or the new Boston Garden, but...
I know, it's a surprise. For years, there had been talk about the Celtics building their own facility, and in fact, maybe even building it more toward where 128 is, so because the Celtics draw fans from this area and from other parts in central and western Mass, but they never have. So they actually have been beholden to the Bruins. The Bruins get the first picks of dates for games and things like that. But the Celtics have won more championships, and the Celtics have done the city proud, no matter where they've been playing or who they're tenants of.
And the Celtics finally, after years of toiling in different places and working at the Boston Arena, yeah, and the Old Garden and heaven knows where else, have wonderful facilities, the Auerbach facilities,
yes,
now that New Balance has,
yep,
provided in Brighton. And when you go to that area, it's astounding to see what New Balance has produced for these clubs. You have the Celtics there, you have the Bruins,
that's
there,
right,
you have the running track.
Yep.
It's something that people don't realize in the city of Boston that's astounding.
It really is. I was happy that they did that, because the Celtics for years were just, you know, they'd have to have their practices, preseason practices at, you may remember, Hellenic College and other places, mm-hmm, Brandeis. But now they've got their own facilities where they can have their training facilities, their weight rooms, their their film rooms and things like that. I'm glad that they did that, and it's nice to see when they show clips of, like, Jason Tatum working out there and getting back to being able to maybe play later this year, possibly, or if not, then next year, and see the banners up in this practice facility as well as they've got in the garden.
Then I think our time is up. And I thank you for all your comments today and for participating in this program. And I look forward to reading the rest of your new book and keeping in touch with you.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Ron. I enjoy this very much. You obviously know a lot about all sports, and it's nice to have these conversations with you. I really appreciate it.
Folks, you have been listening to Audio Journal's Sports Stories with Heart, our effort to look at local, national, and international stories in sports. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Mr. Ron, and I say, have a good day. And if you have any information on any other human interest sports stories and would like us to share it with our listeners, give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. And thank you for listening.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Welcome to Blind Abilities. I'm Jeff Thompson. Ready, Set, Prep. It's a program for pre-ETS taught by rehabilitation teachers. And it's held at State Services for the Blind of Minnesota. As part of their Evolve VR initiative, they created a kitchen, an accessible kitchen that rehabilitation teachers can utilize to teach students. And in that kitchen, there's microwave, oven, stovetop, dishwasher, air fryer, mixers, the whole ball of wax, and a refrigerator, of course. Everything that you would expect to find in a regular kitchen at home. It's all there. The only difference is there's a couple bump dots, tactile bumps that they put on strategically, like on the 250, 350, 450 spot on the oven setting, the on-off buttons, and some buttons on the microwave, dishwasher as well. Adjoining this room is a big open area with some tables, some high tables, some low tables with chairs sitting around. And that's where I noticed that the students, when they arrive, sit down at those tables and they start chattering, and they just fill the room with chatter. They also use it to go check out recipes and to do some minor mixing of ingredients, depending on the size of the groups. And just off that room is an accessible washer and dryer as well. And this was designed so rehabilitation teachers can bring in groups of people to do training. And I was fortunate enough to be there on their last day, and they were going to make cookies. Kia Sadler, a rehabilitation teacher, and Kate Larson, a pre-ETS counselor at State Services for the Blind, were leading the show. And I was curious, so I went right into the kitchen and asked Kate Larson, how did Ready, Set, Prep get started?
Ready, Set, Prep began as my desire to work with Kia more closely. I was able to see how empowering and how confidence building the skills were to a young person. Also, the importance, as so many of our students are maybe the only low vision or blind student in their school, being able to be with other young people in an empowering space where this is their kitchen to explore, this is theirs to really take ownership and responsibility over, where they might have really thoughtful and caring and loving families that are used to cleaning up the table after kitchen, or are used to anticipating their needs, whereas they're getting out all the ingredients. They're putting all of the responsibility with a lot of latitude. I think having a space where they got to learn together and explore.
This one?
Yeah, all right. Boom. Okay, perfect.
So black.
You got this. I also just think having a sense of community while learning something new is just a really empowering space.
I make banana cookies with two ingredients, and they turn out better than these.
Dang!
Oh, okay.
Okay, so there's some recipe talk in this group. I love banana bread.
My mom makes the best banana bread I've ever had.
So what kind of things, like if you guys were to be in charge of running a class like this, what kind of things do you guys want to see happen?
Eggs.
That'd be cool.
I work with eggs a lot.
Like every group is doing a different egg.
Just to fry a single egg.
Yeah.
That's such a useful skill.
Mm-hmm.
Or like making just the basics, like rice. Eggs, rice, potatoes.
I'll make a Korean dish. It's called kimbap.
Ooh.
I would want to make rice balls.
Rice balls, yeah.
I like
we make more spicy food.
Spicy fried chicken.
Like, I might use a frying pan to cook eggs at my house, but someone else might use it entirely different ways to make a bread that I don't even know what it is. And so you learn so much about your community and your broader world through cooking in a way that I think is really expansive. And I certainly learned from the group. There were 6 languages spoken among the students. There's so much that they had in common and so much that they brought to one another. And so I think the opportunity to teach in a group was certainly one that we learned a lot. I learned a lot in teaching in community, but also I think they ideally made community as they learned these skills.
Are we ready?
I think so.
What is the first thing we gotta do before we start cooking, guys?
Ready?
No, before that.
Wash your hands.
Thank you! All right, let's go.
And for me, put a blindfold on.
If you want, you are welcome to do training shades. Anyone is welcome.
And explaining as to why, especially these are your students, that you saw such a need for that connection and for the skills building and how important it really is.
Yeah.
And it was just really fascinating to kind of just hear them interact with one another and just kind of like helping each other.
Yes.
We really emphasize communicating with one another in a small space, and
right.
We did that naturally without really struggling to do so, like happening amongst
the entire stick of butter,
You got this. And as much as we're joking about the cookies not turning out great today, I think learning and problem solving
add more like sweeteners or vanilla to the actual.
Oh, is it not sweet?
No.
It's not very sweet though.
I love how critical you are. This is so good. This is such a good skill as a baker. Like, what a great thing to learn without the pressure of maybe wanting to do it right in your own house.
Exactly.
Like, you get to make mistakes here.
This is the perfect environment
exactly.
to mess up the cookies. I'm glad, because they were so self-aware in the sense of critical of themselves. And that's how you become a good cook. Recognize that even though they might not have very many cooking skills, they're recognizing, hey, this does not taste right. This either needs to be cooked longer or whatever it was. I mean, done a lot of stuff. I mean, this was only a 4-series class that we had, and the first time was just learning about different tools in the kitchen and exploring the kitchen space. And then our second class, we had a no heat prep lunch, so they learned all about spreading and
washing different ingredients.
Yep, and making their own sandwiches. And they had to learn how to shred a chicken.
Yeah, that was the second
class. That was the second class. So we started them right in. And so like they had like a rotisserie chicken that they had to learn the different pieces of the chicken and learn about shredding the chicken and whether or not to keep the skin, and learning that the chicken is tied up with the cooking twine and how to untie that and throw that away. And so they learned quite a bit. And then their third class was adding heat to it. So they made them English muffin pizzas in the oven. So they learned all about oven safety and all that fun stuff. And then today was using the oven again and making a recipe, a cookie from scratch, which, by the way, is really, really tough. And
totally.
I was saying to Kate, this is not something that I would definitely jump the individual student into. Like, okay, now you've learned how to use the oven, you're going to make a cookie from scratch. Like, we don't. You know, but this is just to give them a taste, because they have such varying skill levels.
Yes.
And it's really good for them to work with one another. So I really think that group instruction is so important. I'm really glad that there is, like, we have a kitchen here now for those that maybe the kitchen space in their homes is not the most accessible for them, you know, or parents aren't the most comfortable with them.
For sure.
That. That's totally okay, because these skills are transferable.
Yeah, we're gonna turn it on high speed.
Okay.
All right, hands up.
Okay. I'm curious, have you talked to your family about what you've been doing in class?
My mom asks 24/7, so even if I don't want to talk about it, I have to.
My older sibling will be there, like, okay, and you're gonna tell me all about what you learned today.
Oh, enough.
Why?
So,
you know how to cook. I'm so proud.
So are they asking you all to make more stuffs in the kitchen?
Actually, yes. My dad fried up the peppers that I cut up one time.
Nice. For a first time go, I learned a lot about the timing and just kind of working with students with having different skills. One of the biggest things I learned is that we need more time. 2 hours is definitely not enough, but it's hard to fit the student schedules in along with this class. But I think one of the things that Kate and I noticed is that, you know, having that social connection really is so important, and learning like these skills while being social has been so beneficial. The first class was so quiet, and then by the end of that class, everyone was chit-chattering. So having that time built in for just kind of social interaction and just kind of learning in a slower pace will be, I think, something that I incorporate the next time we do this again. It definitely taught me that a lot of our students really do need this program, and just they talked about wanting to learn more practical
dishes. This class was really meant to be very, very intro, very basic, talking about reading packaging and not like just learning how to make a no-heat lunch to learning how to spread. And one of the bigger things that I really wanted them to get comfortable with was looking for items. So a lot of times what I've been seeing is students not going into their family fridge or into the cupboards to get themselves things. And that was a big part of this program, was having them search the kitchen for things and having them finding things. And they learned a lot about different gadgets and different, like a garlic press, or what is a scooper, what is a spatula, what is a frying pan, what is the difference between a frying pan and a saucepan, what is a colander. And then we had like a smell, like the first class we had a smelling and touching game, so they had like different things they had to learn about, like what is a sweet potato, what is a potato, what is an onion, garlic, all these different produces and different, like, how do we tell like what's in this can if we cannot read the label? And it gave me a lot of insight as to where the students, each and every one of them, were in regards to even just their adjustment to vision loss. So that was really important to nail down. Hey, there are non-visual skills that you can learn when you can see what's on the label. Or even if you can, how would your friend who couldn't see the label figure that out? So that's why we had everyone sniffing the cinnamon and talking about the salt and the pepper, and that the salt is heavier than the pepper, and that there are non-visual ways to figure out these things. So I think overall, it being our first class that we ran, having 2 hours, I think that it went really well. One of the things I really want to focus next time is also, besides cooking and stuff like that, is the cleanup. But I think it went really well.
Yes, half cup butter, exactly.
Yeah,
where's the butter? I've got the short name.
Really enjoyed being at the Ready, Set, Prep program. This was the fourth class of 4 classes, 2 hours apiece, and it was the inaugural class that Kia and Kate put on. I think just witnessing the students' confidence as they learned and as I heard how they grew from the first class to the fourth class, it's a wonderful class for them to have an opportunity to get a taste of the experience of cooking and to learn how to make ovens and microwaves accessible just by placing tactile dots in certain locations. They learn from Kia and Kate, they learn from each other, and I imagine now that they got a taste of it, they'll keep on learning, and hopefully they'll teach their parents that they too can participate in the cooking at home. So whether you're a student, a parent, or a teacher, and you're interested in learning more about cooking from SSB, let them know. Give SSB a call, talk to your counselor, ask your teacher, and find out what your state services for the blind can do for you. To find out more about all the programs at State Services for the Blind, contact shane.desantis@state.mn.us. That's shane.desantis@state.mn.us. Be sure to contact your State Services for the Blind, your Voc Rehab, and find out what they can do for you. Live, work, read, succeed.
When we share
what we see through each other's eyes, we can then begin to bridge the gap
between the limited expectations and the realities
of blind abilities.
And the realities of blind abilities.
Of blind abilities.
This is Bird Note. Today, winter still holds sway over much of North America. Trees are bare. Spring wildflowers and the songs of most birds are still months away. But well south of the equator, in Argentina, it's summer and birds are in full voice. Argentina's national bird, the rufous hornero, belts out a rapid trill. It's a rusty brown bird, the size of a towhee. From the woods nearby, a lovely song breaks forth. It's a rufous-bellied thrush, a near look-alike of our robin. In northeastern Argentina, a strange sound echoes through the mountain forest. It's a male red-ruffed fruit crow booming out its display calls. Although black and crow-sized, with a gleaming red chest, the fruit crow is no kin to our crows. but a cousin of South American bellbirds. Finally, the cheerful, bubbly notes of an ultramarine grosbeak are a reminder that our spring and the arrival of birds like the rose-breasted grosbeak isn't too far off. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Art Kahn and Hardy Pyle waged a bet on who could stay underwater the longest without the aid of any breathing apparatus. Hardy jumped in the pool and managed to stay under for 1 minute. Art knew he could never beat Hardy's time using his method, but he did win by staying under for 2 minutes using an old trick. What did Art do?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
Art Kahn filled a cup with water and stood under it for 2 minutes.
And now back to our regular programming.
And now, medical myths and facts with Dr. Richard Curtis.
Been to a pharmacy recently? With collagen supplements in the news and their possible benefits, what would you pay to have chemically processed skin, bones, and connective tissue of animals in your system? It seems that collagen supplements are everywhere, from skincare shelves to fitness aisles. And The Economist, in its August 2025 article, offers a level-headed take. Collagen might help, well, a little. A handful of small trials suggest it can reduce wrinkles and improve skin elasticity, but the effects are modest, and while it's safe, it's not a miracle fix. So what if there were a more complete and better studied alternative? Enter whey protein. Whey is a byproduct of cheese making and a complete protein, meaning it contains all 9 essential amino acids your body can't make on its own. Collagen, by contrast, is incomplete. It's rich in glycine and proline, but low in tryptophan and several other key aminos. That limits its value for building lean muscle, maintaining general protein balance, and supporting recovery. Why does that matter? Because your body doesn't absorb collagen as collagen. It breaks it down into amino acids, which are then used wherever they're needed. Skin, yes, but also muscle, enzymes, and hormones. If you're low on overall protein or amino acid variety, collagen may not be used where you want it. Whey, on the other hand, is backed by decades of research for preserving muscle mass with age, improving recovery after exercise, supporting immune health, and yes, indirectly supporting skin and tissue repair, since all protein contributes to collagen synthesis. In fact, with the utilization of GLP-1 agonists such as Ozempic and Mounjaro, which reduce muscle mass, the use of whey has surged. So while collagen supplements may target skin health narrowly, whey offers broader and better studied benefits, including for skin, especially when combined with vitamin C, zinc, and a healthy diet. So bottom line, if you're choosing just one protein supplement, whey is the more complete, versatile, and evidence-based choice. Collagen is safe and may offer a subtle cosmetic boost, but it shouldn't distract from the fundamentals: total protein intake, balanced nutrition, and sun protection.
Hi, the Bay State Council of the Blind
has available free Braille copies of a new publication from the CDC. It's entitled COVID-19 Vaccination Guidance, and this one-volume publication focuses on information about the vaccines and vaccine safety. To get your free copy, send your name and mailing address to kim.charlson@perkins.org. That's kim.charlson@perkins.org.